everyone, and a warm welcome to this special edition of the Slightly Foxed podcast, celebrating a very special book. My name is Rosie Goldsmith. I'm a broadcaster, journalist, and host of the regular Slightly Foxed podcast. For this one-off special, I'm in my home studio in Wiltshire in the UK, and my guest is the author Joanna Rakoff, who's joining me from her home in Massachusetts in the USA. We're here to talk about Joanna's incredibly successful and popular memoir, My Salinger Year, which has just been published as a Slightly Foxed Special Limited Edition. Here's my copy. Now, welcome, Joanna, and apologies for my over-enthusiastic use of the word special, but this is a special occasion. You, I think, have just received your copy in the post. Would you like to give us would you like to open it on camera?
Yes.
Let's have a look.
I would love to.
Let's have a look.
Okay.
Did this arrive from London?
It did. Yeah, I think it took a long time because it had to go to my original publisher first. So somehow it took longer.
Round and round, and now it's here. I can't believe you just received it, but that's wonderful for all of us.
Yes.
Okay. Oh, you've got little goodies as well. Slightly Foxed goodies.
Slightly Foxed
the catalog. Excellent. And I think you had a little tote
really
bag there as well.
Bookmark.
And your bookmark. You do realize that you're now a Slightly Foxed club member. There's no escaping now.
My husband this morning said, "You're not slightly foxed, you're very foxed."
And there's your book. Look at that.
And so here it is, and I'm holding it upside down. Here it is.
Isn't it just beautiful? The cover is so gorgeous, isn't it? The color is wonderful.
Yes, it's beautiful. It looks like an Everyman's Library edition, which I don't know, are those known in the UK?
Yes,
but
yes,
yeah.
Indeed, yes.
Oh, I loved them as a kid and collected them. I still have a zillion of them. And, oh, I love it. It's beautiful.
Oh, I'm so, so glad. Anyway, wonderful that you can open it with all of us here. So let's just talk about it. My Salinger Year was originally published 10 years ago, and here it is still going strong, translated now into several languages and made into a film with Sigourney Weaver and Margaret Qualley. There's also a BBC Radio 4 documentary and this gorgeous new edition from Slightly Foxed. Congratulations, Joanna, it is so beautiful. Now, so much has happened in your life and the life of this book since you wrote it, but if we may, let's go back to the beginning. Once upon a time, there was a young woman, an English literature graduate, as you. I'll let you take up the story. This is 1996. You just moved to New York.
Yes.
Tell us more.
It begins really in 1995. I had graduated from college, like many American students, and wanted to be a writer. I wanted to be a lot of things. I also wanted to be an actor. I wanted to make films. I wanted to do many, many things that seemed sort of unattainable to a normal middle-class daughter of a dentist from the New York suburbs. And the safest route for me seemed to be to go to grad school. And I had fallen in love with London. I spent my junior year abroad in London. And so I applied to grad school in London really as a way to go to London, not because I wanted to be an academic, not because I wanted, you know, to get a doctorate or what have you. But while in grad school at UCL, I started to feel the pull of actual writing, you know, rather than academic writing, in a really profound way, and ultimately dropped out of my program. I finished my master's, left, went back to New York really spontaneously. I had been offered a spot in the doctoral program, writing on film studies. I didn't really respond to the professor who offered me this spot. I just kind of packed up my stuff and left. My parents were not expecting me. No one was expecting me. And I got home and just kind of acted like a very young idiot, and we saw my friends from high school and college, went to parties. Most of my friends were living in Manhattan and Brooklyn. And at one of these parties, a friend of a friend was telling me about her job in publishing. She worked for a Random House imprint that produced science fiction novels. And she was this very serious kind of, literary type. And I was very surprised by this. And due to my surprise, I asked her a lot of questions about how she wound up in this place. And she ended up saying, you should go to the headhunter that found me this job. And I had no intention of doing this at all, as she said it to me. I was probably half drunk, or a little tipsy. But the next day, I suddenly thought, well, maybe I should, maybe I should go work in publishing. I think I just didn't know what exactly I wanted to do. And working with real live writers, being involved in the production of actual literature that people were reading seemed more exciting to me than academia, than writing these sort of very densely researched papers that no one was going to read. So I did, and I was actually told by the headhunter, it might be hard to place you because you're sort of overqualified, and you have this master's, and they're going to be suspicious of you and what have you. And also, this is a terrible time of year to look for a job. It was right before Christmas. And I said, okay. And I just thought, okay, that's done. I'm never going to get a call. And got back to the apartment that I was staying in. And the phone rang almost immediately saying, we have a job for you, we think, if you'd be okay working at a literary agency rather than a publisher. And I had absolutely no idea what a literary agency was or how it was different than a publisher. So I said, of course, I would love that. Sure, absolutely. And the rest is this book.
The rest is history. I mean, seriously. So there you are in New York. You're pretty broke. You didn't earn very much money, wanting to be a writer, not knowing what a literary agent was or agency was. And you spent a whole year working as an assistant for a very distinguished New York literary agency that you don't name, and you also don't name your boss, or I think you changed the names of all the characters in the book. But this agency clung on to the old ways, didn't it, too? The ancient typewriters and the dictaphones and the index cards and carbon copies. But it was an agency that represented many of the major American writers of the 20th century, including J.D. Salinger. Now, you didn't know what a literary agency was. You didn't know that it was J.D. Salinger. So tell us what happened. How did you discover that they represented him?
I essentially discovered it by accident. The agency really almost thought of itself, if I can refer to it as an entity. All of the people that worked there, many of whom had worked there for decades, they really thought of themselves as kind of almost like celebrities. And my boss and everyone there just assumed that I knew who they were. I knew what this agency was. I knew everything about them, and that I just sort of had this body of knowledge, that I suspect maybe other assistants who were coming from more culturally sophisticated or privileged backgrounds, maybe they had. So perhaps other assistants were more kind of publishing insiders. Their parents were editors or other agents, or I don't know. And they came to the job knowing what this agency was, knowing the kind of cachet they had, and the power that they sort of had, or they had once had, and they kind of had now. But I had no idea. And I mean, I knew nothing, absolutely nothing. And I did get the sense when I went in for my interview and when I arrived on my first day that they represented some venerable writers, because I sort of saw their books on the bookshelves. The offices, just so you can picture them, looked kind of like a robber baron's library, or like the library at a country estate. Lots of dark wood, and the walls were truly lined with books, like every wall lined with bookshelves. And so I noticed, some great mystery writers like Ross Macdonald, who I actually loved and had grown up reading. And I noticed actually Dylan Thomas and F. Scott Fitzgerald, but I was too nervous to kind of really inspect the bookshelves. And on my first day, my boss kept referring to someone named Jerry, and I had no idea what she was talking about. And it was only when I left her office after she had called me in and kind of spoken stringently to me about this Jerry person that I saw a whole wall of Salinger books. And those spines are, of course, iconic. The designs of them are linked purely with Salinger. We had had them in my house growing up, as did probably everyone. Certainly where I lived, everyone did. And I recognized the spines. I was like, oh my gosh, J.D. Salinger of all people, whoa. And it took a beat before I thought, wait, what is his name? His name is Jerome David Salinger. Oh my God. Oh my God. And I really a little bit felt like I was going to throw up. I don't know why. It just somehow seemed like too much. Like, what have I gotten myself into here?
You didn't know who you were dealing with, obviously, but it's so warm and funny and honest the way you write about it too. And I think that's what, one of the great strengths of this beautiful, beautiful memoir of yours. And I wonder actually, Joanna, whether you'd give us a taste of that particular passage when your very formidable boss calls you
Absolutely.
in.
Sure. Okay. Let me find it.
So you're going to read to us from your new copy of Oh Fantastic.
Yes, here it
I think
is.
page 39, inscribed on my heart.
Yes. Okay. And just to set the scene, this is my first day, and I really had absolutely no idea what was going on. And I'd never had an office job. I'd never had a professional job like this. And I just assumed that someone would come and say to me, oh, it's lunch. Go eat your lunch. But no one did. And so I just stayed at my desk until really late in the afternoon. I was absolutely starving. And finally, a man who in the book is called Hugh, who is a little bit like the office manager, noticed that I was sitting there terrified and said, you should go get lunch. And I left my office and discovered that in this neighborhood, which is Midtown Manhattan, very close to Central Park, to the southern end of Central Park, almost across the street from the back entrance to Saks Fifth Avenue, where I'd been a million times with my mom, but I somehow had never quite thought about the neighborhood in this way. I'd never really been there as an adult. So I went out to get lunch, and even the cheapest sandwich at a really unsanitary looking deli was twice what I was anticipating paying. I had no money at all. So it was a sort of terrifying prospect, but I was too scared to tell the people at the deli that I couldn't afford the sandwich. And so I bought it and was like, oh, there goes my budget for the week. So anyway, this is what happens when I get back to my desk. Back at my desk, I set down my sandwich and slipped off my coat. As I pulled out my chair to sit down, my boss appeared in the doorway to her office. Oh, good, you're back, she said. Come in and have a seat. We have some things to talk about. Glancing sadly at my sandwich, wrapped tightly in white butcher paper, I walked into her office and sat down in one of the straight-back chairs that faced her desk. So, she said, settling in her own chair behind the vast expanse of her own desk, we need to talk about Jerry. I nodded, though I had no idea who Jerry was. People are going to call and ask for his address, his phone number. They're going to ask you to put them in touch with him or me. She laughed at the ridiculousness of this. Reporters will call, students, graduate students. She rolled her eyes. They'll say they want to interview him or give him a prize or an honorary degree or who knows what. Producers will call about the film rights. They'll try to get around you. They may be very persuasive, very manipulative, but you must never. Behind her huge, heavy glasses, her eyes narrowed, and she leaned across the desk like a caricature of a gangster, her voice taking on a frightening edge. Never, never, never give out his address or phone number. Don't tell them anything. Don't answer their questions. Just get off the phone as quickly as possible. Do you understand? I nodded. Never, ever, ever are you to give out his address or phone number. I understand, I told her, though I wasn't sure I did, as I didn't know who Jerry was. This was 1996, and the first Jerry that came to mind was Seinfeld, who presumably wasn't a client of the agency, though one never knew, I supposed. Okay, she said, sitting back in her chair. You understand. Now, go. I'm going to take a look at your correspondence. She gestured to the pile of letters I'd typed, neatly stacked on her desk. Seeing them, oddly, gave me a little rush of pride. They were so beautiful, that heavy yellow bond crowded with letters in inky black. As I left her office, smoothing my skirt, I happened to glance at the bookcases directly to the right of her doorway, on the wall opposite the side of my desk that held the typewriter. I'd been staring at that bookcase all day, staring at it without seeing it, so focused was I on my typing. The case held books in corresponding hues, mustard, maroon, turquoise, imprinted with bold black type. I'd seen these books countless times in my parents' bookcase and the English department closet at my high school, at every bookstore and library I'd ever visited, and of course, in the hands of friends. I'd never read them myself, do it first purely to happenstance, then to conscious choice. Books so ubiquitous on the contemporary bookshelf, I barely noticed them. The Catcher in the Rye, Franny and Zoe, Nine Stories, Salinger. The agency represented J.D. Salinger. I'd reached my desk before it hit me. Oh, I thought, that Jerry.
Spine chilling, even now, however many times I've heard you read that before. It's absolutely fantastic. It's just so wonderful. And it's so, it actually sums up the whole novel, because it's all like that wonderful open-eyed wonder at so many new discoveries and new life and new people. And it's full of great characters. I mean, the boss who you are meeting there, you describe her at one point like a cross between Don Corleone and Lauren Bacall. Carl. I can sort of imagine that. And they're all very, very interesting, colourful characters. Now, they are not the real names, of course. You've been very protective of people, but I think a lot of people have guessed, haven't they, who she was anyway. This New York agent, very, very famous woman. But they hold a lot of power, don't they, the agents? And that is something that you learned and celebrate in a way, I think, in this book, too.
Yes, very much so. I mean, I feel like I should explain, though, that the agency, in a way, was in decline. You mentioned that they really were holding on to these old practices, as in it was 1996. I suppose for anyone listening to this who's 20, they're thinking like, that was 100 years ago. Probably people did use typewriters, but they did not. You know, no publishing house. What is the word I'm looking for? No publishing house in the United States, at least, had typewriters anymore. Everyone used computers, email. Obviously it wasn't as fully digital as we are today, but correspondence was largely done over email. You know, people did have cell phones. But at the agency, a fax and a copy machine were basically considered newfangled devices. And my boss kind of thought of them as caving to the horrors of the contemporary world. And I don't quite know exactly why they kind of clung to all of these old practices, because they extended into their approach to selling their clients books, meaning making money. And I suppose this is why I mention it. Their clients who were, unlike Salinger, producing new work, were being sold and marketed in a kind of, I think of it as a kind of like gentleman's sort of way. Whereas the practice in publishing at the time was to auction books. You know, you would, an agent would send out a manuscript to 8, 10, 12, maybe more editors at different houses, and those who were interested would bid against each other to get the highest possible advance for the writer and the agency, who took a commission, of course. And my boss was radically opposed to this practice. She thought it was gauche. She thought that it was sort of money grubbing and horrible. And yet this is what people did. And so this meant that many of her clients had these absurdly tiny advances, a few thousand dollars, when another agent might have gotten them a few hundred thousand dollars. And it made for a difficult situation at the agency. They were kind of coasting along on royalties from their legendary dead clients, like F. Scott Fitzgerald, who was a continual source of money for them. But those clients, their works were all going into the public domain. The copyrights were running out, meaning that source of revenue was at its end. And they were really not in an ideal place. And I think I at first felt, oh, I'm working for this very powerful entity. And as I navigated that entity, I became aware of the ways in which they really were kind of a dinosaur and were losing power. And it seemed honestly tragic on a near Shakespearean level to me. No one was dying, but no one was murdering each other, but it still felt very wrong. And it also felt unnecessary. It felt to me a bit like it was my job to kind of save them and to save my boss from herself a little bit. And I did definitely spend a lot of time trying to subtly convince her that, some of these newfangled things were okay. And she did move an inch or two in the direction of the 20th century, which was at its close at that point.
I think that's what's so attractive about this book as well. Another great reason. It's on the cusp. You're describing an era of great change and upheaval in publishing and in the world. And it also, you were at the time a very young woman, early 20s, and you were going through yourself, enormous changes, decision making, and so on. And you just had this 1 year there. And you were working in this slightly antediluvian situation, but you were doing great things. And because you were responding to J.D. Salinger's enormous volume of fan letters, weren't you? That was one of your main tasks, was responding to the letters he received, because he was, from what I understand, enormously reclusive and didn't want to meet anyone. Also, hadn't written anything new for quite a long time. So it was all very strange, shrouded in mystery.
Yes, that is absolutely right. And for me, there was a little bit of extra mystery because I had not read any of Salinger's books, not because I was some kind of, uneducated Neanderthal or whatever, but actually because I thought they were beneath me. I thought of myself as a tremendous intellectual, and I thought of his books as kind of popular entertainments, because they were so beloved by everyone in the world. Even people who did not think of themselves as readers, I just thought they must be kind of like lowbrow or middle brow and not of interest to me. And so the tremendous outpouring of love and obsession and what have you that came in the mail every day was, I think, maybe extra fascinating to me because I had understood that Salinger was, as you said, reclusive. I knew that because everyone knew that. It just, he was almost, here again to use this word, he was almost more of a celebrity than a writer at that point. He was as famous for being reclusive as he was for The Catcher in the Rye. But I also knew, that his books had sold millions of copies and that he was beloved all over the world. But I didn't quite understand the extent of it until I'd been there a few days when Hugh, this same person, came over to my desk with, he was kind of holding several bundles of letters that were wrapped in rubber bands that had been just been dropped off, under his arms and in his arms, and he dropped them awkwardly on my desk and said, oh, by the way, these are the Salinger letters. You're going to need to respond to them. There's a form letter somewhere. I'll dig it up for you. And I said, what? And I didn't realize, that hundreds and hundreds of letters came in every week. And some were sent actually to his publisher, Little Brown, who happens to be my publisher now. And then they were passed on to us, and some were sent directly to us. And it was really a life-changing experience. Even just reading these letters, it made me think of literature, of books, of stories, of characters in a very different way. I think I really had been this kind of academically minded, intellectually minded kid who thought of books as something to critique, to dissect. I'd always had like a critical bent. And these letters made me see the extent to which fiction really can change people's lives and can make them. This sounds very cliched, but I really mean it earnestly, like, can make people feel less alone in the world. And I mean, can save their lives for real. Because these letters, they ran the gamut. I mean, they came from all over the world, people of all ages, genders, but a lot of them were these kind of outpourings of the soul. Some people really did say that Salinger had saved their lives, that they had felt alone in their despair. We would now sort of just say that these people were depressed. That isn't the term that they used actually in 1996. And reading not just Catcher, but a lot of people wrote about Franny and Zoe or Nine Stories. They talked about how reading about the experiences of his characters made them for the first time feel that someone else had experienced what they had experienced. And I was just profoundly moved by them. I had a bit of an arc. At first, I was like, whoa, wait, what is going on here? Who are these people? Wait, these people are crazy. I'd never written a fan letter in my life, And I thought, don't they know he's not going to write back to them? He's the most famous recluse in the world. Do they really think he's going to see their letter and be like, oh, so I'll write back, But in reality, I think that many of these fans actually did think that Salinger would see their letter. He would be so moved by it. He would see that they were kindred spirits, and he would feel moved to write back. I really got that sense from these letters. Not that it was hard to get that sense, because many of them essentially said that in the letter. So yeah, it changed my ideas about what literature is, what its purpose is, how it functions in the lives of humans.
So it didn't stop you wanting to be a writer at all. It sounds as though it encouraged you even more to become a writer.
Yes, it did. And it made me I think that it made me become a writer, actually. It fully made me become a writer. It allowed me to just embrace that impulse and desire. I began writing much more regularly and much more intently, with much greater purpose and confidence and sense of what I wanted to do during that year. And I should perhaps add here that Salinger himself very much encouraged me, not because he read my writing and thought I was a fantastic writer. I don't know why he did actually, but maybe I should back up actually and explain that this year that I worked at the agency was quite unusual. The next conversation that I had after the little bit that I read, the next conversation with my boss was one in which she explained that sometimes people take this position thinking that they'll be in touch with Salinger all the time, that he'll become their best friend. But in fact, really, the agency never heard from him. And when he did call, it was just to speak to my boss. And he didn't talk to anyone other than the receptionist who'd worked there forever and, whom he knew. And she knew just to put him directly through to my boss, whereas all other calls were sent to me. Every single other call, that wasn't a personal call was sent to me first. And even that, Rosie, seems like an archaic practice, right? I don't think that is how, maybe I suppose I have a film agent, right? And that's a little bit how her office works. It's really hard to get a hold of her. You have to go through her assistant. And I think in Hollywood, there is a level of that. But in most places, you don't have to go through someone's assistant to talk to them now. You just call and leave a message on their voicemail. The office had no voicemail, so I was the voicemail. And anyway, but in fact, what happened with Salinger is essentially that day he called and was put through to me. My boss was not there. I was shocked and so shocked that I really didn't know what to do. He also, as I think is quite widely known now, but was not at the time, was quite deaf from, artillery. What is the right word? Like bombings in
Yes,
World War II.
artillery fire. Because
Artillery
he
fire.
fought in the Second World War, of course. Yes, and he'd suffered greatly.
He had, yes. I mean, he was definitely traumatized by it. And you see it in his character of Seymour Glass, definitely. I personally think you see it a lot in The Catcher in the Rye in a kind of symbolic, metaphorical way. But he writes about it directly with Seymour Glass.
So there he was shouting. I recall, from your description of the book, he was shouting down the telephone, and you were the one at the end of I mean, it must have been the most extraordinary moment for you.
Yes, I mean his speech was somewhat garbled because of his deafness, and he actually his wife, who was a nurse, had procured for him an amplified phone, which is a really common thing to use if you have hearing loss, but he refused to use it, which I suppose is probably normal in people who don't want to admit that there's something wrong, like my mom did that with her amplified phone. But I had trouble even understanding what he was saying. And then slowly the words kind of began to crystallize in my ears. And I realized, oh my gosh, he's saying, it's Jerry. This is not Jerry Seinfeld. This is Jerry Salinger. And he is kind of presuming that I know who he is. He thinks probably that I'm the old assistant and that I've spoken with him before. And so I explained that I was not the old assistant, that my boss wasn't there, and he seemed very anxious to get in touch with her. And to make a long story, the story of a whole book, short, he was quite anxious to speak with her because he had decided to publish a new book, which was not actually new writing. It was simply a standalone edition of a very long short story, kind of a novella that he had published in the New Yorker many, 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 many years before in the 60s. And he was excited about this idea and wanted to talk to my boss about it immediately. And he did move forward with this idea. He and my boss moved forward with it against the advice of everyone else at the agency. And what that meant was that I was in touch with him all the time. He that once a year call that my boss had warned me about became at least a once a week call. And he, I found, was very different than I had been expecting, and different than I had heard all of these kind of urban legends about him being crazy and mean and yelling at people. And there's this whole story about him punching a photographer. And I was imagining him as this kind of like angry, belligerent, I guess kind of like Holden Caulfield sort of person. Right, who hated everyone, but he was not that. He was this very gentle, very patient, very kind, older man. He was quite elderly at the time, and he was very, very kind and generous to me, and would ask very much paid attention to what I was talking about, and he gathered from a small thing, a small comment I made, that I myself was a writer, and he would call and say, how is the writing going, and would give me little bits of advice. And some of those pieces of advice I still use to this day, decades later. He was the one who said to me, "You have to get up before everyone else in your house and write, because that is when you're thinking most clearly." I'm paraphrasing, but he just said, like, if you don't write first thing in the morning, the whole day is going to get away from you. And he would also say to me, "You're not a secretary, you're a writer. This is just a job. Don't get too, embroiled in the agency. You're a writer. And you have to make sure if you," he sort of was telling me that if I got up and wrote every day before work, then I would stay a writer. Whereas if I didn't, I would, and just kind of lost myself in the agency's business before I did anything else, I was never going to be a writer. And this rang very true for me. I happen to be a morning person who likes to wake up very early. So I did start writing every morning before work. And I still do that today. I wake up, now I have kids and a husband and a dog who needs to go out. And I wake up before everyone, not the dog. And right in this office here by myself, usually for an hour or two before anyone even speaks to me, all
It's
because of Salinger.
not many writers have received advice from J.D. Salinger, so I can tell. It makes your book even more special. But he died in 2010. He was 91, I recall. I remember very well. And this was before you wrote the book, because you were in your early 20s. It was 1996. You didn't write the book for about 20 years after the actual events. So how did his death affect you, and how did it affect the writing of the book?
That's such a good question. And it's one that I don't think anyone in all the hundreds of interviews I've done has ever asked me, actually. Thank you. When Salinger died, I remember the day that I got the news. I had two small children. I just published my first novel. And I thought about thanking Salinger in the acknowledgments, actually, because he really had been the person who had kind of allowed me to develop the habits that led to that novel. And he also had sort of instilled in me the belief that I could do it, and could kind of stick to my guns and write the book that I wanted to write, partially by example, just watching him kind of be who he was and not care about what the world thought of him had been a huge lesson for me. And when he died, I was kind of trying to figure out what I was going to do next. As I said, I had two small children that were still very attached to me. One was a baby. And I got the news that he had passed away. It was nighttime, and I just put my kids to sleep. And I just found myself overcome. If you had asked me, would you be overcome? Would you start sobbing at the news that Salinger died? I would have, of course, said, no, I didn't know him that well. He was a marginal figure in my life. He did have this one effect on me, but that's it. I have no right to cry. He's not my relative, and instead I found myself sitting, I lived in New York at the time, sitting in bed in my apartment, sobbing, just uncontrollably sobbing. And I then walked over to the bookshelf in my living room, took out Franny and Zoe, and started reading it. And it felt like a different book to me somehow than it had. I'd read it many times. And I don't know, somehow reading it led me to think about him, who he was, how he constructed the world, who he had been in my life, in a very, very different way than I had. And what actually happened is that after his death, I was contacted by a few different radio shows and asked if I wanted to write a piece for them, and also a magazine. And in this kind of raw place, I said yes. And it just kind of poured out of me. And that is what led to the book.
So it all came together, really, because you'd also been writing journals all the way through your time at the agency, as far as I recall. So you had a lot of material in your head, and then you researched an awful lot as well. So, you can feel it coming through the pages of this book, and it makes it even more profound, I think. Hearing you talk about it now as well, and what I know you met him once, but we'll leave everybody to read that in the book. I think it's another wonderful event. Now, I already see your book as a classic. How do you explain the continuing appeal of My Salingeria, of your memoir? Because people love it.
I know it's kind of crazy to me. I think it's crazy in part because this was meant to be an interstitial book for me. I really think of myself as a novelist. I write a lot of journalism and essays for magazines and book criticism and stuff like that, but I think of myself as a novelist, not a memoirist. I'd never really written about my life before this, and I was very nervous about doing so. And the idea of the book was actually presented to me by an editor in the UK. And I said, no, I'm not a memoirist. I don't really read memoir. I don't know how to write about myself. I don't think I'd be good at it. And eventually I came, or it took a long time, actually. It took months, which at the time seemed like a long time. Now that seems like nothing. But I came around to the idea. And my agent and I thought of this as just a little book that I would kind of toss off because, as a novelist, I write kind of big, broad social novels that take years. And Tina, my agent at the time, said, think of this just as a magazine essay. And I said, okay, I can do that. And it took longer than I expected, but it still, I thought of it as a little book. My publisher kept saying to me, that is my publisher in the US. I will say that my publisher in the UK had a very different story. They saw the book very differently. In the US, they kept saying to me, there's a really limited market for this book. This is really just going to sell to women, probably women in New York. It's really sort of a publishing insider's book. We're not seeing this as having broad appeal. And so, even to this day, 10 years later, I still have those negative voices in my head saying, like, this book has limited appeal. No, but like, three people are going to read this. And all these years later, it's been published, in a zillion countries. It's been made into this big Hollywood film. So, I'm not even answering your question, which is, what is the appeal of it? And I think that it's partly maybe simply that it is a coming of age tale that is written with a lot of transparency. And I think that for people who are very young, they kind of see themselves in this story and relate to everything that happens in there, the sort of confusion and the disorientation with the world, the having no money, the trying to sort of find your way in a kind of bumbling manner, and to looking around you for role models and not really seeing anyone living their life the way you wanted to. But I think for what I've found, just from the mail I get and people that I meet while endlessly touring, people of all ages seem to see themselves in this character, the character of me, and be transported back to an earlier time. But there's one tiny thing that I'll mention, which is I think that the appeal of it might have something to do. It's hard for me to say this because I feel like I'm being like, I'm amazing, but I wrote this memoir as if it were a novel. So I wanted it to, have a beginning, middle, and end, and have a very defined story arc. And I changed the names of everyone before I even started writing so that I would be thinking of it as a novel. I had a little post-it that said, this is a novel, you are a character, pinned up on my desk. And my secret is that I really think that the appeal is partially due to the way it was written, that it can feel a bit more immersive than some memoirs.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, you're ticking all the boxes. You really are. It's also, as you can see, if you're watching this on YouTube, I mean, this is my copy of My Salinger Year. It's highly covetable as an object. I don't know whether we're allowed to talk about books as covetable objects, but it certainly is. And if you're listening, you'll be able to see a copy also on the Slightly Foxed website. But only 2,000 copies have been printed. Now, each cloth-bound hardback in this beautiful dark russet orange is numbered by hand from 1,000 to 2,000. And mine is number 657. There you are, 657. What's yours, Joanna?
Mine is 374.
And there's this beautiful real silk ribbon marker as well. And this is definitely a book to smell and touch and read. The haute couture of publishing, if you like. Now, this highly acclaimed series of Slightly Foxed editions encompasses some of the best and most important memoirs and biographies of the 21st century, with authors on the list such as Hilary Mantel, Jan Morris, Roald Dahl, E.H. Shepherd, and now we're delighted to say Joanna Rakoff too. Now, Joanna, just a couple more questions from me about the book before we finish. Now, when it's described as a literary The Devil Wears Prada, how do you feel? Is that accurate?
Okay, I've never actually read The Devil Wears Prada. I've seen the
Did you
movie.
Watch the film? You watched the film?
Yes. And so I see the comparison just in that it is about an assistant. I think a really big difference, and I hope it's okay to say this having not read the book, but based on the film, I think one difference is simply that the world in which the main character of The Devil Wears Prada, in which she operates, is a much more kind of glamorous world in which there's a lot of money at stake. And her boss is very much a gatekeeper. She's really trying to kind of weed people out, keep her out, as is, you know, as are the other assistants at the magazine. Whereas I think the world of My Salander Year is a much gentler, less commerce-driven world. There's much less at stake financially. And in a way, that's sort of what the story is about. The agency kind of coming to grips with the ways in which publishing is becoming more commerce-driven, becoming more diverse, becoming just very different than what it was when the agency started out. So I think that the worlds are quite different. From what I understand, the style of the book, The Devil Wears Prada, is quite different. I don't know if that's true. That's just what I've been told. I probably should read it, right?
Maybe after this, but your memoir, as we talked about, was made into a film in 2020, and you were a consultant on the film. Now, funnily enough, clothes were quite a key factor of your film as well, not Prada, but you'd bought a few charity shop clothes in London, which you proudly wore, and I think they were actually used in the film, weren't they?
Yes, yes, a little bit. I consulted on sort of every aspect of the film, like in an official capacity, I feel like I should say, and worked on the script as well for years. And the costumer for the film, there were two different ones, but the one who ultimately chose everything and designed everything, we worked together really closely. She's an incredible costumer who's won many awards, and she really wanted to see every picture of me from that time. She wanted to hear everything about every object of clothing I had worn. And I'm a person who loves clothing. I was raised by a mother who, you know, really did actually wear couture, like, and was somewhat, I would say, like, fashion and clothing was kind of her hobby, really, or her reason for living. And so I'm not quite that bad.
You're speaking my language, I hasten to add. So I'm delighted to hear all this.
Yes, and I think clothing is very important in the book. I just will take a moment to say, in that part of what I was looking at in the book is the ways in which young women present themselves to the world. And when you're first starting out, the ways in which the clothing that you wear to work is both kind of an armor to kind of protect your tender little baby soul inside, and also a costume. You're trying to present yourself as the person who is qualified for this job. And for me, it was publishing. So I felt that I needed to present myself as kind of like a, I say in the book, like Sylvia Plath at Smith. You know, I wore pleated wool skirts and sweaters and twin sets and pearls and loafers and that kind of thing. And I actually know because my boss told me that that's why she gave me the job. She thought I looked like an agency sort of person because I did have this kind of old-fashioned look. And in the movie, no, all of that clothing, most of it was, you know, charity shop, thrift shop, you know, clothing. Like none of it. I was a very, very skilled thrift shopper who could find, you know, the like Pendleton sweater at the charity shop, that kind of thing. But in the movie, the costumes were not just based in general on what I wore, but they were actually based on specific items of clothing of mine. And now here's a fun, weird thing. Some of them have become cult items, and you can buy replicas of them. The big one being the green, there's a green trench coat that is based on a trench coat that I still have and wear that I bought at Camden Market when I was a grad.
Amazing. What an amazing story. You never know, there might be a fashion line one day. Maybe that'll be another string to your bow. You'll start up a fashion line. My Salinger year fashion line.
Someday, a
My
girl can
goodness.
dream.
Oh, so many wonderful stories, Joanna. Thank you so much for all this. But you were only there a year, and this was obviously enormously formative for you. And you remained in the literary world as a novelist and literary journalist and editor and so on. When you look back to 1996, how formative was it? Do you look back as being very positive? Was it just, self-discovery? Was it as we've been discussing as well, an ode, if you like, to a pre-digital literary age of publishing? I mean, how do you see it? How does it all come together for you?
I think that for a lot of people, that first job is so formative. And somehow, you know, Rosie, I think back on other jobs I had. Like I worked in publishing for 2 years after I left the agency, at a different, smaller agency that gave me a little bit more flexibility with hours. And I remember some things from that job, but not that much, you know, and that was 2 full years. And that year at the agency, I remember so many specific moments. I remember what I was reading. I so remember, I have this incredible sense memory of just what my days were like, that I would leave the office, you know, in the spring, and I would walk this specific route to the subway where, you know, I passed by this very little branch library, and I, if it was open, I would pop in and see what they had. And, you know, the places where I got coffee and my morning bun, and I remember everything about it. It's so strange. And I think maybe because it's such a departure from the rest of one's life, you know, until that moment, one has kind of been under the care of one's parents, hopefully, if one is lucky, right? And provided for. And then there's this shift into having to fully take care of yourself and be a grown-up, responsible person in the world who has the kind of mastery of all of these adult things, and at one's office, I think you're working so hard to kind of give the impression that you know what you're doing. And somehow maybe these moments imprint themselves on your brain, in a really profound way. So I do feel like it was a very, very formative year, and I still feel the repercussions of that year all these years later.
Amazing. I'm so grateful to you for all your stories and your wonderful effervescence too. It's just amazing. And I've just had so much pleasure reading this book. So thank you very, very much indeed, Joanna. In spite of all the UK US time difference, your enthusiasm and energy just bounce off you. So Thank you for that. I still need to meet you in person, though, so you can sign my copy of My Salinger Year. Thank you, Joanna.
Oh,
My
thank
Salinger
you.
Year by Joanna Rakoff is out now. It can be shipped almost anywhere in the world from our London office at a cost of £18, including post and packing to Slightly Foxed magazine subscribers, or £20 to non-subscribers. Do head to the Slightly Foxed website for details. That's foxedquarterly.com. And if you live in the UK, visit your local independent bookshop to buy this special limited edition of Joanna's memoir, My Salinger Year. And don't forget that you can subscribe to Slightly Foxed Quarterly's literary magazine also via its website. I've got my copy of the spring edition here, issue number 81. And this features original writing from Miranda Seymour, Alexandra Pringle, Vesna Goldsworthy, Anthony Gardner, and there's an essay by Frances Donnelly on none other than Joanna Rakoff's memoir, My Salinger Year. Slightly Fox subscribers often tell us that being a subscriber makes them feel more like part of a worldwide club of fellow book lovers. So join the club. As a subscriber, you receive four beautifully produced issues of the quarterly per year, access to the entire digital archive on your phone, tablet, or computer, 81 issues and counting. You also get reduced prices on all books on the Slightly Foxed online shop, invitations to events, and more besides. And don't forget to tune in to our quarterly podcast hosted by yours truly. Our most recent episode, number 49, is all about farming with Sarah Langford, farmer, barrister, and author of the acclaimed memoir of her life on a small 21st century farm in Suffolk. This inspirational book is called Rooted: How Regenerative Farming Can Change the World. Sarah speaks as brilliantly as she writes, as you'll hear. Do have a listen. Available via the Slightly Foxed website and on all your favourite podcast platforms. I'll be back on the 15th of July with episode 50 of the Slightly Foxed podcast, when we'll be exploring the extraordinary life of novelist and artist Barbara Cummins with her biographer, Avril Horner. My name is Rosie Goldsmith. Thank you so much for joining us for this special one-off event with Joanna Rakoff, author of My Salinger Year. We hope you enjoyed it. Warmest wishes from all of us at Slightly Foxed. Goodbye.